Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast where real engineers get together to talk nerdy. It's a special place where we never have to apologise that you, or I, or anybody who's on the show, don't know what a packet or a router is, because we all know. That's it, nerdy. And here in the virtual boardroom, there's a special cherished place where we gather to wave our hands at the virtual whiteboard, get excited about technology, disappointed about what the vendors have given us, because it's never, ever good enough. Let's face it, discussing technology, networking technology is what we care about, and we do it nerd style. Before we get the show started, I just wanted to very quickly plug a few things about the show. You are welcome to contact us, and we do encourage you to send your feedback through to packetpushers@gmail.com. We are on a bit of a recruitment drive right now to try and get some more listeners and some more followers and fans and all that sort of hoo-ha up to the show. So we wanted to ask you this week to go out and tell your friends, not grandma, I don't think grandma would be all that interested, but tell your friends and the people in the networking community that come on down and subscribe to the show. As we get a few more subscribers, it makes it ever easier for us to negotiate with the vendors and get a little bit of cash through the door. And speaking of cash, you can always give us a donation. Ethan and I, tonight's show is actually sponsored by Young's Double Chocolate Stout. It's very fine indeed, and thanks to the people who've been donating to us, because it really does help us put the show to air. So if you're able to, consider making a donation to support us in producing the show, and you can always review the show in iTunes and leave some feedback there, because the vendors see that as well, people who might want to give us some sponsorship. So joining me this week is Ethan Banks. Ethan, tell the people what's been happening.
What's been happening? I had a leak in my basement. It's very upsetting, I tell you. I'm still mad about it. I have a split-level home, and so the bottom part of my house is submerged, right? Oh. Well, submerged, I mean subterranean, shall we say. Okay. And it's been bone dry down there. It's a finished space. We live down there. We work down there, and so on. And after 4 hours of torrential rain in the very recent past, a bit of water found its way in and destroyed a significant section of carpet and foam padding underneath, and I'm just distraught about it. And I ripped it all out in a furor, and so on. So that's been happening, and now I have to figure out how to resolve that problem permanently, which I think I have analyzed the problem, and I have a solution. And so I'll be working on that a good bit here over the next few weeks and try to get that stitched up before the winter winds blow, and it is cold weather, snow and ice here in New Hampshire. But on the networking front, because no one really cares about my house, Nexus stuff. I've been doing closing in on putting into production these 5500s that I think I've been talking about for about 20 shows now. Yeah. And haven't quite actually managed to get it done.
God knows I'm bored of hearing about them.
That was mean, Greg. I'm upset now.
I mean, no, hang on, I'll just take another drink. Thanks, sir.
Oh, is it Mickey even meaner?
Well, it'll make me stop caring quite so much.
We can play the Packet Pushers drinking game.
Hey! Unfortunately, I finished the vodka last night. And that voice in the background there is Mr. Tony Burke. Yes, the man with the mullet and the Star Trek fetish like you would not believe. Welcome, Tony.
Thank you.
How you been?
Great. I've been great. Great to be here. I'm in lovely Portland, Oregon, where it's actually been in the 90s for the past couple of weeks. Very, very warm for the Pacific Northwest, or I guess that would be in the 30s for everyone else in the world.
So Pacific Northwest, that's in America, right?
Yeah, okay. In Portland, Oregon.
Not everybody knows where the Pacific Northwest is, because that, you know, where I come from, the Pacific Ocean doesn't really have a Northwest.
Yep, and then on Monday I fly to, or tomorrow I fly to Toronto, and the week after that I fly to Montreal. And in the middle of that, I'm training for my next marathon, which is in your homeland, Greg, in Australia.
Australia! Australia! Yeah. Australia! We love you! Amen! Suck it back.
Sorry. And actually, I'll get to meet a couple of I'll get to see Kurt Bales again, hopefully. And I have a doppelganger down there, Anthony Burke.
Yeah, okay.
He spells his name slightly different than me. But hopefully I'll get to meet up with them in Sydney before I head up to Cairns.
Well, people who don't know, Tony Burke is, of course, the host of the Wrath of the Data Center, which is a podcast focused on his journey to the CCIE Data Center qualification. It's an occasional show, shall we say, because he records it when he's got something to say, which at the moment he's furiously flying around the countryside.
Yep, and we're all on pins and needles. All of us who have taken the beta are still waiting for the results and finding out whether or not we pass the beta and if we can schedule our and then after that we'll be, you know, hitting refresh on the Cisco site for when we can schedule the lab.
Oh, you see, you're going to go straight up first possible day.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to go in blind. It's more of a reconnoiter at that point. I'm just going to go in blind and see what it's like and go for it. Since I'm going to be teaching a lot of the material, I teach for Firefly as well as some other vendors, and we're working on CCI Data Center boot camps and stuff. So
that's exciting. That must be exciting for Firefly. That's not something they've historically been in.
Not traditionally. We've never done a routing and switching boot camp, but we have done the storage boot camp, and I think we've boot camped half of the CCIE storage people out there.
Right.
There's not too many. I think last time I checked, it was just shy of 300.
Yeah.
So pretty good customer interest then in the CCIE data center, or are you guys kind of doing if we build it, they'll come?
We've got some pretty good interest. I've been talking to a lot of people and been kind of tuned in on Twitter and so forth, and there's a lot of people chomping at the bit to get it. I have no idea what that translates into in numbers, but it seems to be a cert that has a lot of interest in it. As we discussed many times before, it's a certification that's not going to be cheap to do in terms of lab equipment. You're not going to be able to build a CCIE data center lab in your basement.
No.
Unless you got one very special basement.
Yeah.
And a very big checkbook funding it. And yeah, perhaps your own small power reactor in your backyard.
I was just going to say, that's just the power bill.
Yeah. Right.
I mean, nobody's ever called a Cisco UCS power efficient. So, not designed to be. Although, apparently in the latest versions, they have focused on power capping and stuff like that to actually cap the power consumption to under a certain amount if you wanted to.
Yep.
And do load shedding. But that's so this show is about UCS networking. So specifically, what's actually happening is Tony and myself are both neck-deep in training content around Cisco UCS stuff, and we started having an argument about VMFX and just how it worked. And, of course, I'm still building up my skills, and Tony's got much more, so I said, why don't we just get together and talk about this? So today is going to be, as always, short on intelligent discussion and long on prognostication and just flat-out making things up. And we hope you'll enjoy listening to us sort of talk through VMFX and FX and how Cisco UCS connects to the network and get some value from it. And you should – it's probably fair to say that Cisco UCS and FX kind of changed a lot in the last 2 years, and it has gone through some sort of adaptations as the product has iterated very rapidly. So I think, Tony, why don't you kick us off with a bit of a description about UCS networking in general to start us off?
If you go back – very complex, redundant networking, very highly configurable and manageable networking where we're controlling traffic flows and aggregating large links, but yet having it channelized so you can carry certain kinds of traffic and so on. This whole solution that we're talking about with UCS and how it hooks into VMware and vCenter and how it presents back to Nexus Gear if Nexus Gear happens to be involved – it's no longer a commoditized sort of a solution. It's a very specialized thing. If you were looking at a Dell solution or you were looking at an HP solution that did something comparable to what UCS is doing, I got to imagine it's a whole different ballgame and different sets of knobs you turn and so on to make it all work. Are we improving things by heading off in a technical direction like this as an industry? It just seems like we got everything stripped down real simple and easy to understand, and now it's blown back out into this very specialized solution to really because of virtualization, and everybody's doing it a little bit different depending on who you look at.
Well, as a network instructor, I'm quite happy to have things this way.
So I have a view on that, which is a bit wafty, and so people might have to bear with me for a little bit. But if you figure that once upon a time servers used to be installed, the operating system was bound to the hardware, and then there might be a backup to it over here, and that was it. That was all we ever had. And now what virtualization says is we can disconnect the operating system from the hardware, and now once we do that, we can start to move the operating system instance from A to B to C to D. Unfortunately, our network remains not an infinitely an infinite resource that's infinitely flexible and infinitely configurable. So if you think about a server operating system, it can run on server A, which has this much CPU and this much memory. And when I shift it to server B, I give it this much CPU and this much memory, and the operating system doesn't, or the application doesn't care, doesn't change. It still runs exactly the same. So there's no resistance in terms of server hardware to taking it, to migrating an operating system and an application instance. So, you know, move it from A to B to C to D. So create a DRS. So VMware has a thing called DRS, Dynamic Resource Scheduler, and it says, oh, hang on, this server over here is running hot. I'll start to pull some VMs off and move them off somewhere else. That's fine for server people where the operating systems instances can be dynamically, because the resources are quite elastic. They don't, and even then, it's not real time. So even if you shoehorned it into something that was running a bit less memory and a bit less CPU and it slowed down for a bit, nobody would really notice. It's not that critical. Maybe people would notice a critical performance application, but you take steps to solve that. In the networking area, though, you might move it from server A, which has 20 gigabits per second of bandwidth, to server B, which has only 10. And now all of a sudden there's not enough networking bandwidth. But this, the operating system, the hypervisor, does not signal as part of the criteria how much bandwidth is available to that server. So today in networking, what we do is we configure every one of the virtual servers with the same amount of bandwidth, 20 gigs per blade, you know, 40 gigs per chassis, 80 gigs per chassis, and then we have everything nice and flat and even. Everything's the same all the way through in the networking. But in 5 years' time, because we plug servers in, take servers out, we're going to have different servers, they're going to be different networks, it's going to be 10 gig, 40 gig, 100 gig. You're not going to have that. We have to have a communication in the resource pool between the virtual server, which is going to say, I need to have this amount of bandwidth with this sort of latency and this sort of performance. Where can I go that's going to give me that? And that's where we need to be 5 years ahead. So I need to be able to say, this is my Oracle server. It's going to suddenly migrate from point A in the network to point B in the network. Whereabouts in my network is a point B that has this traffic profile associated with it, and then it goes there.
I don't disagree about that. I think my point isn't that we need to be able to dynamically and, for the most part, automatically provision network resources to meet the changing needs of the network. I'm all in on that. I'm a believer, and I'm really interested in what the SDN companies are doing like that. Question is that we've got solutions that are so complex and tightly integrated that you can no longer mix and match pieces and parts anymore. Now we're at a point where you've got functionality that is very dependent on hardware. You've got a functionality that is very dependent on specific software, and you don't have the same functionality available to you depending on where you look, and there's not really a roadmap that I'm seeing where that's going to come together, not yet. Right now, it's very much a wild, wild west with all of this, and I don't know.
Well, okay,
I don't know how we get there yet.
Yeah, so at the moment, there's two standards. There's 802.1 QBG, which HP is championing, which does this similar sort of an idea, and then there's 802.1 BR, which Cisco is championing, and they're kind of two different ways of approaching the same problem. The general consensus from what I hear from chatting to just a few people is that they will eventually converge over time. 802.1BR is a replay of 802.1QBH, which was abandoned for some reason that I don't understand in the IEEE. The IEEE doesn't move fast. So I've railed against IEEE in the past and said, you know, you'd see pregnant snails that were faster than the IEEE in a race. You know, the IEEE takes a long time to produce stuff, way after it's, you know, and sometimes so much so that by the time it comes, it's dead. And that's why Trill's been taken to the IETF, is because at least something might get done there in this decade instead of waiting 20 years for the IEEE to pull their fingers out of their bum. So today, everything's pre-standard because the standards bodies are moving slower than we can as a technology. I use the analogy today that back in 1999, when OSPF first started to come out, Cisco's OSPF was not compatible with Nortel, with Bay's OSPF was not compatible with 3Com's OSPF, excepting when Area Zero. When all the routers were in Area Zero, then they all worked fine. But then somebody came along and invented areas and then added that. And then Cisco came along with stubs and not-so-stubbies. And, you know, none of the three com routers could speak not-so-stubby areas, and so that didn't work. And then eventually, sometime much later down the path, everybody converged on an agreed standard. So what we're talking about now is probably, I don't know, Tony, 3-4 years before everybody converges on a solution, do you think?
Yeah, it's... And the other issue is that everything is changing so rapidly. It's hard to even, you know, by the time you finish a standard, it might, you know, like Trill. Like Trill might be completely obviated by VXLAN or Nicera or some other SDN solution. So, you know, things are moving so fast. Things are happening. Usually, I mean, things are usually improving. But the technology
Can
and the
I just
underlying...
argue with, I'll just take a point there. It's not that things are moving so fast. It's that they're moving so slow. The reason, if things had already moved and the problems had been fixed and we'd converged on a solution, we wouldn't be having this discussion. We'd know exactly where we were. What's happening is the vendors are moving slower than we'd like. They're not taking leadership. So you've heard me wail on in the past. Cisco's saying, well, you know, you've got Trill, we do that. You've got, you know, VMFX, we do that. We do VNTag. We used to call it VNLink. Yes, everybody liked it, so now we're going to keep working on that. Yeah, we liked that, so we're going to do that. And now we're doing Nexus 1000V, so now we're doing Nexus. So we're going to do the open vSwitch version of Nexus 1000V. We're going to do that. And now we're going to do some SDN. We're going to give you all of that, and you guys can make up your own mind. Which one do you like?
Well, to speak to what Jeff Doyle mentioned on show 112, he made the point that the large vendors are no longer in a position to really take leadership on that, that it's going to take someone small to really drive changes. And so, yeah, things have been moving slow because the vendors are reactionary and putting their fingers up in the air to see which way the wind's blowing, to see what customers might buy, because they're driven much more by sales than technology.
I want them to be like Apple and take a risk.
Apple and any other company that I've ever seen has, you know, love them or hate Apple, and there's plenty of people in both camps. But one thing that's hard to do with Apple is that they are not afraid to eat their own young.
And not only that, they're not afraid to bet the whole company on one product. So if you look at the iPhone, it comes out once a year. They bet the entire company on that product. If that iPhone fails, have they got a backup? So, you know... And that sort of business strategy just absolutely fascinates me, because everybody who's involved with that iPhone must be absolutely committed to its success, because they know that if they don't, they're dead. So anyway, that's just me. So I think it's just because the industry's moving too slow. They haven't converged. Everybody's trying to get a different idea. There's lots of different ideas in the mix here. We could be doing everything in software. So layer 3 to every single server, and then on top of that is a software switch, and everything's done in software. We don't know what the final solution will look like. This solution with VNTag and VNLink is to say, sure, you can have software switches, but the software switches should be communicating with the physical switches. So why not have a software switch speaking 802.1br to the physical switch and signaling data backwards and forwards between them? That's not here yet, but that's a future that I can envision.
Yeah, that would be nice.
But that would mean that VMware would have to have an API that they could pull from the switch, and the switch would have to be able to talk back to the virtualization platform. What about Xen? What about Hyper-V? What about all the other virtualized? So there has to come up with a standard API. But who's going to develop that API? VMware? And there is some speculation going on that VMware bought Nicera to build that API and to control the development of that strategy. Because that's what's in Nicera, is the people who can make that standard and get people to listen. And because VMware, Nicera's already got a shipping software switch, so they can stand up with great credibility, and then VMware can go on to dominate that piece of the industry.
And more importantly, VMware has, you know, can pitch whatever Nicera becomes, they can pitch it to every, almost virtually every, pardon the pun, virtually every data center in the world, because they have a pretty large footprint in just about every data center in the world.
Yeah.
So they're very captivating.
Did I answer your question, or did I just make it more confusing, Ethan?
It wasn't really a question so much as a topic for discussion, because there is no right answer here. It's too early in the game to tell. We all got opinions. I continue to be frustrated by the number of changes in solutions that are being presented, all these little point solutions to solve small problems without a propensity of vendors that are behind it, it makes it challenging for people who wish to design a network to determine this is a clear and obvious strategy that I should be taking. Instead, there are these 16 different choices with various software licensing and hardware bits that I need to purchase and consider. And I'm not sure what longevity any of these solutions are going to have. And it's a frustrating time when you're trying to build out net new infrastructure to determine where do you put your money down? As you said, it's not going to change for a while. I mean, you suggested 4 to 5 years before we get some harder standards in place and a more generally recognized way to go about doing virtualization. Virtualization of the network specifically. And then we see where that's going to take us. Until then, we have an awful lot of podcasts to record while we keep up with it all.
Yes. But aside from that,
time in networking, or it's a really terrifying time to be in networking. What was the kind of the ominous warning? May you live in interesting times.
Yes, the Chinese term for opportunity is danger and opportunity, or something like that. But
crisis, right?
Yeah,
crisis is danger and opportunity. I forget. Yeah.
So for now, I mean, the answer is that the old networking needs to be more flexible. It's not broken. There's nothing wrong with it. It's like saying that an inline eight is better than a V8. And
I didn't mean to derail the whole conversation that we were really having focused on UCS into something that was more philosophical, but it just struck me as we're going into all these little nuances and different ways to accomplish similar things, and why this, and why that? Well, it solves this little problem, it solves that little problem, and it's like, oh brother, after a while you just kind of throw up your hands.
Well, I mean, and the other side of it too is, you know, how we talk a lot about software control and orchestration and management and administration and SDN. This is where it comes in. So if you think about the whole stack, if you think about you've got a machine, and then your hypervisor's got a software switch, and then in the NIC, you've actually got a hardware switch in there as well. And either the software switch or the hardware switch has now got a communications channel to the upstream switch, whether it's Cisco or some other vendor. So Cisco's using the hardware NIC to talk via the I/O module to the Fabric Interconnect, or in the case of a C-Series, it's talking to the 5000 natively. So how are you going to coordinate all that configuration? Because if you think that a software switch is actually attached to a server and the server is mobile within the data center, how do you bring all those configurations together? And if the software switch is communicating with the physical switch and then it moves from this one to this one, how does the physical switch do the handoff between them? You know, if your 802.1br communication is between your Nexus 5500 and the software switch in a hypervisor, and then all of a sudden a server moves over there, then the switches have to be talking to each other, don't they, to transfer the MAC address.
And all these little bits and pieces of the solution. I mean, speaking as both a network administrator and as a server administrator, the last server admin job I had was about 9 years ago, and I wish I had this when I was a server administrator, UCS specifically, but a lot of this technology in general, because it just makes things a lot easier. So with VMFax or with the faked out NICs or just UCS in general, if I have a dead blade, I pull the dead blade. I don't even have to pull a dead blade out. I just move the service profile to a new blade. I don't have to reconfigure any ports. I don't have to update any BIOS. I don't have to turn off hyper-threading because some vendor told me I had to turn off hyper-threading. It's all done automatically. So in all of this, if I have to move from one blade to another, all the VMFax settings move with it. I can do vMotion with VMFax too. So I can, even though it's a hardware, even though we remove the vSwitch, it's still compatible with vMotion. So there's a lot of, in some respects, you're right, it is kind of all these different specific solutions to it, but it does make a network administrator and a server administrator's job much easier.
Which is clear in that Cisco UCS has had great market penetration and people that use it really like it. I mean, so it's obvious there's a home for this and it's doing well.
It is Cisco specific, and that is something to keep in mind. And I mean, it's my favorite blade system, but part of that is familiarity versus superiority. Like, I would pick UCS over HP, but that's because I'm, you know, I know a lot about UCS and I don't know so much about HP, but I'd still pick UCS anyway. But it is a fantastic product, and I'm not, you know, I don't work for Cisco, so I'm not legally required to say everything Cisco does is awesome. And I, you know, you've heard some of my rants about the Cisco ways.
Yes, we have.
Yes, but join the queue.
I love
the way that. So I've been teaching UCS for about 2 years now, and you're right, it has changed quite a bit, both in terminology, the terminology that they've used to describe the different functions and features and products, and in terms of what's possible. So when I teach it, I typically do kind of two views: the top down view, what the networkers see, and the bottom up view, what the server people see. So from the top down, we have the two fabric interconnects. If this were MTV Cribs, I would be pointing at the fabric interconnects and saying this is where the magic happens. They're the management point. They connect your northbound network. They connect your southbound network. Northbound is going to be your traditional LAN and SAN infrastructure. So at least be an Ethernet network, and probably will also include a fiber channel, native fiber channel network. So no FCOE northbound yet in UCS. In northbound, it can be whatever switch you want. It can be a Nexus 5000, 7000. It can be a Juniper. It can be Arista. Cisco would like it to be a Nexus, but it could be any Ethernet switch you want northbound. But do you have to have a pair of fabric interconnects? And then they can also connect to any fiber channel vendor that you have. So if you want to connect to Cisco MDS, that's fine. If you want to connect to Brocade, that's also fine. Through the magic of NPIV and NPV. Southbound, that's where things get really interesting networking-wise, because southbound, from the fabric interconnects to the UCS chassis, they connect straight through. So in networking, we tend to cross-connect everything. So if we have four switches or four routers, we'll cross-connect them any way that we possibly can. To set up even a hypercube if we could. You know, is there any way that I miss cross-connecting these? Because I totally have more cables, that kind of thing. the fabric interconnects connect to the chassis in sort of a in the way that the fiber channel does. So we have the A fabric interconnect and the B fabric interconnect. And they're actually not cross-connected for either Ethernet or fiber channel. So they're two independent data paths. Yeah. And into each chassis has two IO modules. Those are the uplinks to the fabric interconnects. And those run FCOE. So it's an Ethernet link that has encapsulated fiber channel frames riding along with the regular data traffic.
That's the 22.
A little different of a description than what I really thought UCS was. My impression as a guy on the outside who has not had to deploy UCS was that it was more of a, here's a mix and match of custom pieces that we've thrown together here, some PC stuff kind of off the shelf, and here's some of our switches, and we threw it all in this box and called it a unified compute system. There's actually a lot more to it than that.
Yeah, it definitely is, and it's very different than any of the other blade systems out there, at least from what I know. The closest would probably be the HPC 7000, UCS's biggest competitor, but there's still very significant differences in how things interact and how things are wired.
And more importantly, Cisco, all of this piece that we're talking about is all Cisco's custom silicon. They sort of took the 5500 silicon and put it into a chassis and then added a blade on top called the UCS Manager, and it's actually an Intel board, and that's the fabric interconnect. So it's part fiber channel, part Ethernet, part management engine. So it's actually like a server inside of that 6100, 6200. And then that – sorry?
Yeah, exactly right. And it's based on the – so the 6100 series is based on the Nexus 5000. The 6200 series is based on the Nexus 5500.
Yep.
They're really the same hardware, except the fabric interconnects have some additional hardware in them, so you can't take Nexus 5500 and turn it into a fabric interconnect or vice versa. So they don't transform.
Yeah. The thing to think about is that the UCS system is actually made up of multiple parts. You've got the fabric interconnect at the top, and there's two models, 6100, 6200. And that connects inside a B series, so that's the blade servers. In the chassis itself has a thing called the UCS 2200. Which is not a switch, it's actually quite like the Nexus 2000 switches. So it's a fabric extender. So there's no local switching internally. Its ports actually appear on the fabric interconnect up the top. And then inside each blade, there's a NIC. Is that right, Tony?
Yep. So yeah, the fabric extenders, each fabric extender only plugs into one fabric interconnect. So there's an A fabric extender and a B fabric extender. There's a little bit of confusion in the terminology, too. Traditionally, in the UCS world, we call them I/O modules, but technically they're FECs, fabric extenders, and you'll see them used both ways.
Yeah, that's true. You see a lot of graphics with IOM on them instead of FECs. So as of now, it's FECs, people. FECs, not an IOM. I think that's HP speak, isn't it? They call them IOMs.
Maybe. I'm not sure. But actually, I tend to still call them IO modules, and we can have a good fight about that.
Yeah. No, you're not allowed to call them IO modules anymore. I said so.
We'll get another load balancer application delivery controller debate.
Yeah, well, yes. Bridging or switching.
Yep. And then so every blade has a NIC in it, or what Cisco calls them mezzanine cards. They're PCIe adapters. They don't have the traditional PCIe pinout form factor, so they have their own special pinout, but it's all PCIe electronics. And every NIC that you can get from Cisco, whether it's in Broadcom, Intel, or one of the VICs, will have at least two interfaces, one going to the A side and one going to the B side. So from the server's perspective, you always have two ways to get out. So you, in Ethernet perspective, this is also a very important distinction. From the server's perspective, if you have a mezzanine card that can do fiber channel, even though it's FCOE, you still see native fiber channel. You have no idea from the server's perspective that you are running FCOE. Because the interfaces that you see are fiber channel interfaces. You load fiber channel drivers. You do fiber channel fabric logins, port logins, etc.
Yeah, because the NIC, so the NIC that's actually inside the server that's connected to the PCI presents a fiber channel hardware to whatever's installed on the blade. And it actually appears as a fiber channel HBA and as a Ethernet NIC. So you see both, even though one card, but both are on there. And that's not new either, because Emulex has been doing that for a while, and QLogic.
Yeah.
With their fancy, they call them converged networking adapters. So for the last 5 years, you've been able to buy a thing called a CNA, which goes into a server. And the CNA has been, you know, PCI compliant card that goes in, and it's fiber channel, and it's also Ethernet. It does it on one chipset, so that you're only taking up one slot instead of two. So instead of having one slot used for an Ethernet NIC and one for a fiber channel, this CNA. And the reason for that is because a fiber channel NIC has a big ass CPU in it to do all the fiber channel processing. So because fiber channel needs low latency, it doesn't rely on the software to do the CPU processing of the fiber channel packet creation and munging. Has a big ass CPU on the fiber channel NIC. So that they said, well, let's just put some Ethernet in there, and it's, you know, it's not too much difference. So that's not new either, if people think that's new and fancy.
Yeah, exactly. It's been around for a little while. But the difference in UCS perspective is that you'll have two fiber channel interfaces at least and two Ethernet interfaces at least. One goes at the A side, one goes at the B side. So you always have two ways to get out. And like I said, the fabric interconnects themselves are not interconnected. So there's always two independent data paths going out of UCS.
Now, with those two ways to get out, to get is that an active standby sort of a setting where the B side is effectively unused until needed?
They're active. Well, it's actually up to the operating system or the hypervisor. They can be active-active. You can run both at the same time. And for example, VMware, the default fiber channel drivers for VMware will do active standby. So it'll use the A path or the B path and then will fall back to the other fiber channel path if one of the links goes down. Or something like EMC PowerPath can actually use both at the same time, as far as I can recall. On the Ethernet side, VMware does a really good job of utilizing multiple uplinks, using split horizon so that you don't, so you can have both paths active at the same time. It'll pin certain VMs to one path and certain VMs to another path. It'll use split horizon so it doesn't forward any unknown frames and cause bridging loops, and there's no spanning tree, which is really nice. So you can use both A and B path for both fiber channel and Ethernet simultaneously.
Although from a design perspective, you'd want to make sure you never go beyond 50% capacity if you're going to use both at the same time.
Exactly, because if you lose one, then you'll be in a degraded state.
Yeah.
That's true, except there's now an active standby at the physical level as well, isn't there, in Apex?
Well, so one of the cool things that you can do with the VIC card, so most of the NICs you can get from Cisco, most of the mezzanine cards you can get from Cisco, you can get one from Broadcom, you can get one from
Intel.
You can get a combo, a CNA from Emulex, and you can get a CNA from QLogic. And those are do exactly what we just described. And then there's the Cisco VIC. The latest model is the VIC 1280. There's also the 1240. And what they can do is they can fake out these interfaces. And they can also fail over in hardware. So I created a NIC. So the server, and this is, I'll traditionally use this if I'm running Windows Bare Metal. So let's say I've got Windows Bare Metal and I've installed it on a blade. Now, I can give this Windows system two ways out, but it's not going to be able to use both of them. And I'll have to set up some weird NIC teaming drivers, and I actually can't do LACP because I'm having two different paths out. So what are my options? If I have the VIC, this is what I would do. I would present to Windows, I would just activate one PCIe interface for the Ethernet driver. So the Windows would see one 10 gig NIC, just one. And I would enable a feature called fabric failover. So Windows sees one NIC. Maybe it's going out the A side, maybe it's going out the B side. I can pick. If the A or B side, whatever side I'm using, fails, the NIC will switch over to the other side.
Yeah.
And the Windows won't.
In the mezz card on the motherboard, it'll say, I know there's two paths from down to the A fix, the AU2200 or the B2200. If either path fails, what that means is the path actually is from the NIC. So it goes mezz card, UCS2200 fix, 61 fabric interconnect at the top. So if the fabric interconnect, the AF fabric at the top fails, then the fix 2200 will fail, and the NIC will go, hang on, that path is now dead. I'll switch over to the B path. And then the data will now flow transparently to the server, transparently to the Windblows. It'll now flow out the UCS2200, then out to the B fabric 6200, and then on to the Nexus 5000 or 7000 above that.
Yep, you can lose the links from the fabric interconnect to the I/O module or to the FEX. You can lose the FEX itself. You can lose anything on the A side, and it'll detect that, and it'll switch the traffic over to the B side or vice versa without the Windows having to do anything. Windows won't even know the link went down.
No.
It'll see a few frames drop, but other than that, it'll be fine.
Now, those of you who are howling things about MAC addresses and everything, that's what the fabric failover feature does in the fabric interconnect. It allows MAC address syncing, and it knows when this failover happens, and it reprograms the MAC tables transparently to the user.
Right.
And so the upstream actually knows what happens, and it'll switch it over without any intervention. So that is my mind. That's AFEX. Is that AFEX, or is that...
I don't exactly know what to call it. I think that's just VIC. I don't know what the marketing term for that feature is, other than fabric failover. But it's not AdapterFX, and it's not. It might be a subset of VMFX, but VMFX typically refers to something else.
Well, I found out something interesting the other day. The connectivity between the VIC card and the UCS2200 FX is 10 gigabase KR.
Yep.
So there's an Ethernet standard called 10 gigabase KR. Part of the RFCs, it's designed as backplane Ethernet, and it literally is a 10 gig channel defined down a backplane, and it's all prepped. So Cisco didn't invent that. They just took an existing standard and an existing backplane. So the whole of UCS is off-the-shelf componentries. Much of the gear is off-the-shelf. So as Tony said a minute ago about the mezz card, the PCI chipsets that they use to interface to the Intel motherboard is all off-the-shelf components. The VIC itself is the magic source. Only parts of the solution are Cisco-specific.
And the VIC card is from Project California. It's called the Apollo card, although it's not referred to that as Apollo card anymore. But it's mostly off-the-shelf components, which is nice.
Yeah, that's one of the confusing things, is that the weird naming conventions for a lot of this kit. When Cisco acquired – this is more of an aside. It'll be less of a problem going forward. But when Cisco acquired What's the name of the company that did the UCS stuff? I can't remember it.
Nuova. That was the Nexus.
Yeah. And the UCS stuff as well. So the chipsets inside of that thing were called the Altos ASIC, which is the crossbar switch in the thing. Then there's the GaDOS ASIC, which is the media access controllers. The Redwood ASIC, the Menlo ASIC, which was part of the UCS 2200s is the Menlo, I think.
Oh yeah, Redwood is part is the IO module.
Yeah, the effects. And then Menlo ASIC is on the... Huh.
Yeah, it used to be on the Emulex and Qlogic cards. So there used
oh, that's
to be,
right. It was the... Yeah.
The Menlo chipset was the one that used to combine the fiber channel and Ethernet and did the encapsulation and did the FIP and all that. But the second-gen Emulex and Qlogic cards do not use the Menlo chipset anymore.
It's been retired. So now there's the Palo, which is now the... VIC cards, so you tend to hear the Palo being called the VIC. You won't see it called the Palo so much anymore. And then there's the Catalina and Anacapa ASICs, which are used in the blades to do the large memory. They're their proprietary. They're the technology that Intel and Cisco got together to develop to do the double memory configurations.
Yeah, and that's not actually used anymore in the blades. There's only one blade that uses that now. That's the B250 and the C250. You both use the extended memory, and that was to get around the limitation of 18 DIMMs or of 9 DIMMs per CPU on the Nehalems. But the newer chipsets like the E5s and E7s can have 16 DIMMs per CPU.
Yeah, no, they still have a doubler in the newer B400s. I thought
you might be right.
I think I might have some inside information. There's new blades coming out that will have the doubler back in, I think.
Yeah, there's the B420 and the B440. The B420 has 48 DIMM slots, two CPUs or four, and it can take up 1.5 terabytes of RAM.
Ridiculous amounts of memory. Handy for those database applications where they want to run in memory, which is the use for that. So bringing it back around to networking, so we talked about what the FEX can do.
Mm-hmm.
So we talked about the FEX actually physically emulating, presenting one physical NIC to the operating system, but actually hosting independent paths down through the IO, through the IOM FEX and to the FI. And then we've got other things, haven't we? Is this a good time to start talking about VNTAG and VNLink?
Yeah, so there's with the VIC card, there's a couple of cool things we can do, and some of them are actually very different from each other. The first thing, and I think the most common thing that I see the VIC being used for, is for VMware. So kind of to go back a couple of years, when I took my VCP4 training, so I'm VCP4 and VCP5 certified, and to take that, to get that certification, you had to take one of their courses. And I remember they wanted you to have at least, I think, 6 NICs, 6 gigabit NICs on your ESXi host, if I recall correctly. And the reason was that they wanted you to separate out, especially your vMotion traffic, your fault-tolerant traffic, your VM kernel traffic, which might include your NFS and iSCSI traffic, and a redundant setup for your vSwitch, for your data traffic. And that ran well and good, and probably a majority today of ESXi hosts have that sort of setup. They have a couple of quad cards in them for gigabit Ethernet. But as people have moved towards 10 gig, that presented a little bit of a problem. How do we separate out this traffic? So one of the cool things you can do with a VIC card is you can fake out a bunch of new NICs. So even though you have two interfaces, physical interfaces, one going to the A side, one going to the B side, up to 40 gigs per side depending on your configuration now. So the VIC 1280 gives you 40 gig to the A side, 40 gig to the B side if you have the right I.O. module and enough uplinks. So instead of VMware seeing two NICs, you can present it 6 NICs or 8 NICs, 8 10 gig NICs. So that you can separate out your traffic. So you can have one pair of NICs or for your NFS traffic, another pair is for your vMotion traffic, another pair is for your regular vSwitch.
And again, this is what you're presenting to the hypervisor. This is not what the hypervisor is presenting to guests.
Correct. This is what you're presenting to the hypervisor. When the ESXi boots up, it will do a scan of the PCI bus, and it will see six PCI addresses. So it thinks it has – the physical hardware is abstracted, is virtualized, and the physical hardware presents to the hypervisor six NICs or eight NICs or 10 NICs or whatever I need to do.
Yeah, it all happens at the PCI bus. So
correct.
The PCI inside the server that in the old days you used to be able to look down and there'd be three PCI slots or five PCI slots. That was the PCI bus. And in the B-series servers, that bus is purely logical. There's a MES card, and the MES card then says, I'm going to insert this many NICs onto the PCI bus. And whatever operating system, Linux, Windows, Hyper-V, Xen, even VMware, if you like paying 80% gross profit margins for something. Did I say that out loud? Harsh. they'll scan the PCI bus, and whatever they see on the PCI bus is what the operating system can then make use of.
Yeah, the operating system cannot tell that these are not real NICs.
Yes.
So these are faked out. Now, there is another standard that is something like this called SRIOV, Single Row I/O Virtualization, that requires the operating system be in on it, that it requires support from the operating system. What the VIC card does not SRIOV, although it can do SRIOV, it does not require the operating system be aware of this. So the operating system doesn't have anything to do with it. The operating system is presented with whatever fake NICs you give it. So that way you can do things like rate limiting on the NICs. So, for instance, vMotion on a 10-gig link with vSphere 5, I can actually flood, if I do enough vMotion simultaneously, I can saturate a 10-gig link. I may not want to do that. So the fake NICs that I give for my vMotion interface, I may set it up so that it's rate limited to 2 gigabits per second. So it will not be able to – in fact, the NIC will see a 2 gig link and will not be able to push more than 2 gigabits per second out of the 10 gig link.
And where is – there must be a traffic shaper on the VIC that is doing that throttling?
It's actually done up in the Fabric Interconnect. So all this is configured from the Fabric Interconnect. It can be templated. It can be standardized so that when I deploy a new blade, all this is applied automatically. And I don't need to configure ports or anything like that. It's just all done. So we should step back real quick to describe one of the features of UCS, which is called the service profile. Now, I am a former condescending Unix administrator. So I started out in the networking world being a Unix administrator, doing Solaris administration and then Linux administration. And we had this thing that we did in the late 90s and early 2000s that we don't really do anymore in networking. And I don't know in server operations. I don't know if you guys did it in networking, but you named servers after like Star Trek characters or cartoon characters or whatever. Did you guys ever do that?
Yeah, I did, right the way up until when Warner Brothers sued somebody for naming their servers after Homer, Marge, Bart, thing.
Okay, so
mostly Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, but guilty, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of something public domain I can use now.
Greek gods, Roman gods, Norse gods. Mm.
Yeah.
Planets in the Alpha Centauri, stars in the Alpha Centauri region of space.
Yeah, yeah. Alpha Centauri Proxima, Alpha Centauri Alpha, I think those are the names. Anyway, so we have the, we name servers after whatever, after planets, Jupiter, Mars, etc. In UCS, we don't name the blades anything. We have something called a service profile. And so when we create these fake vNICs and we create the QoS and rate shaping parameters for these, we actually do it in something called a service profile. And we'll name those, the service profiles, Mars, Jupiter, Venus, whatever. And then we apply it to a blade. So they're portable. That's another feature about UCS, which is really nice. But so you don't have to configure ports or anything. You just apply to the service profile. You apply the service profile to the blade, and all the networking magic is done automatically. So there's rate limiting you can do on every faked out NIC that you have. And then there's traffic shaping So you can configure minimum bandwidth for each of the cause values. So I can start creating these cause lanes, and I can say this is going to guaranteed at least 10% of the bandwidth, or at least 20%. I can use more than that, but it's guaranteed always at least 20% if it needs it. And that's done to these NICs. And that's especially popular with VMware, so that I can do these, I can do things on vMotion and fault tolerance and all that. And actually, bradhedlund.com is where I soaked up all this information when I started out. So Brad Hedlund was a Cisco, I think he was a TME for ECS. Mm-hmm. He's since moved to Dellforce 10. Mm-hmm. Smart guy. Definitely follow him on Twitter and check out his blog, bradhedlund.com. So he writes about, he does a lot of Hadoop stuff now. But his UCS posts are still there, and they are golden for learning about UCS, especially UCS networking. So he's got a great post that talks about all these different scenarios for VMware where you can fake out all these NICs. You can do fault tolerance NICs. You can do vMotion NICs and so forth. And that's something you can do with a VIC. In fact, most UCS blades are sold with 90% of them are sold with a VIC. I think 90%. I don't know, but
yeah,
most of them
I saw some research. I saw somebody, one of the analyst firms, says he believes that less than 2% of people, 2% of sales of NICs is not the Cisco's VIC, whether it's the Palo or the later generation, whatever.
Yeah, I believe that sounds about right. So I hardly ever see anything that's not VIC.
Yeah, yeah. To all intents and purposes, the fact that you can buy an Intel and a Broadcom NIC version of these MES cards, which is just like the olden day Ethernets. The only time you would buy them is if you're doing something quite specific and you want to save a few bucks. The Cisco VICs are reassuringly priced. They are reassuringly expensive in every single way you want to talk about it, but you do get a whole bunch of features. And once you buy into UCS, you kind of want those features, don't you? I mean, if you're going to buy it off on the UCS strategy, you want to have the toys to play with. You don't really want to, you know, hamstring them with the legacy stuff.
Yeah, so faking out these NICs, that's the most common way that I see these VICs used, is to be able to do this with VMware. Because most of the workloads that you stick on UCS is going to be virtualization. And by the way, it doesn't work with just VMware. You can also do this with Hyper-V and KVM and any other operating system that you put on there, because it does not require any operating system support. And all the network control is at the fabric interconnects in the networker's hands.
We'll dive into this a little bit more, but it might be a good point to deviate into Nexus 1000V and how it works here.
Okay.
Because the Nexus 1000V is a software, a replacement for the vSwitch in VMware, and sometime later this year it will also be able to replace the virtual switches in other operating systems too. So Nexus 1000V is planned for Hyper-V, or announced and planned for Hyper-V and KVM and Xen. The KVM and the Xen solutions are a fork of the Open vSwitch project, and Hyper-V is a partnership with Microsoft, so that Cisco will have software switching solutions for all of those. And the Nexus 1000V has a software sits in the hypervisor and gives you centralized configuration point back in the Nexus 1000V supervisor engine. So you can, instead of configuring the vSwitch in VMware or Hyper-V or KVM, you actually configure it in a supervisor module using the traditional Cisco Nexus CLI, and it looks like that. Now, that sits above this. So whatever VICs we present from the VMFX card into the server is then what Nexus 1000V looks like. At this point in time, there's no integration between the Nexus 1000V and the VICs or the UCS. They're all completely different, completely isolated products at this point in time. And when I say at this point in time, I would reckon there'll be something between them in the future, in a couple of years' time.
Yep, and the Nexus 1000V in no way requires UCS. So you can run the Nexus 1000V on any infrastructure that you have running VMware, but it does require Enterprise Plus because it is a distributed virtual switch.
Yeah.
Which is not an inconsiderable jump, as I understand it. We've talked with the VMware environment for the office environment that I support most heavily is Enterprise, not Enterprise Plus. And again, that seems to be a fairly significant jump in licensing costs to get all those additional features.
Yeah, last time I checked, I could be wrong. I could be wrong about anything. But last time I checked, it was $3,500 per socket. For Enterprise Plus for vSphere 5. and that gives you 96 gigs of VRAM allotments, or VTax is
80% gross profit, 88% gross profit. Sorry, there was an article this week talking about VMware's profit margins, and it's 88% gross profit.
So, those poor bastards.
Microsoft is the same sort of numbers, by the way, so don't feel special. It just seems like, you know, when you're making 88% gross profit margins, it seems a little ridiculous to just keep gouging even further. But anyway, not there, not there. I'm sure they're spending lots of money on R&D and stuff. So we still don't think we've covered VNTag and VNLink yet, have we?
Absolutely not. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of cool stuff you can do with UCS. So VMTag, VNLink, VMFex. So VNLink was the old name, and they've gotten rid of it. So Cisco no longer calls it this. They started calling it 802.1 under its pre-standard, 802.1QBH, but they've rescinded that draft, and they've submitted a new draft, 802.1BR.
That's capital B, capital R.
And it used to be capital Q, lowercase bh. And so it's basically it's a header you flap onto a regular 802.1Q Ethernet frame that lets you know what port or what virtual machine a frame originated from. So it gives you a little bit more intelligence into the endpoint. It's what the FEX, the 2200, is based off of, we think. I think I remember Ivan Pepelniak talking about not knowing exactly what goes on there.
I believe they're using VNTag, which is a pre-standard version of 802.1BR.
Yep, and 802.1BR, I believe, is a pre-standard itself. I don't think it's been ratified yet.
It's in par, so it's been started, initiated, and I believe it's close to finishing. Last time I checked. So it's Cisco Live. So there's a presentation from Cisco Live called BRKDCT-2340, and it's a presentation on 802.1BR from Rene Reber, who is the man leading Cisco's initiative in the 802.1BR. And that presentation is quite long, but it actually has a section talked about VNTag to IEEE 802.1BR migration and how it addresses all the questions that you might have about it. Actually, it's very good.
Okay, I'll check it out.
Yeah,
that's a lot of the core technology in UCS, but that's most of this behind the scenes. So the faked out NICs, they get a VN tag associated to them, so that the fabric interconnect can tell those NICs apart from the blade perspective. But most of that's underneath the hood, and you're not going to see that either configuration wise or if you do a packet trace or anything like that.
Not going to see it and don't even have to care if you're a UCS administrator. Is that what you're saying?
So just like with the Nexus 2000, you don't have to. You don't really care about VNLink or VNTag. It's the same thing with there. It's an interesting technology to know about. But for the most part, you don't really care about it.
Gotcha. There's not going to be a setup screen or a configuration screen you're faced with where you've got a provision. What are my VNTag infrastructure going to look like? It's just a mechanism used in the background to help distinguish the different traffic streams.
For the most part, that's right. There's only one that, and we'll get to that when we talk about VMFX. Is that a good transition to VMFX?
Sounds like it is.
Perfect.
So VMFX is used to be called PTS, pass-through switching. It requires – it's something that works with VMware right now, and it works with KVM, with Red Hat KVM. What it does is it replaces the vSwitch. So like the Nexus 1000 will replace the vSwitch in VMware, VMFX will also replace the vSwitch in VMware. And they're mutually exclusive. You can't run both at the same time. You can run the VIC in Nexus 1000, but you can't run the VIC in VMFX mode. So this requires the VIC to do this. So the VIC can run in a mode called VMFX. And you load up a little software module in your ESXi hosts, and it kicks out the vSwitch or supplants the vSwitch with the hardware itself. And there's actually two modes to do VMFX in. There's emulated mode and VM direct path mode. but they both do pretty much the same thing. They replace the vSwitch. You get a VM tab in your UCS Manager, and it basically will join UCS Manager with vCenter. So you have to go through a couple steps to join to build a relationship with the UCS Manager into vSphere, so that when you create these port groups, port profiles in UCS Manager, they show up in vCenter. So you create all the networks in UCS Manager, and when your VMware administrators go to create a new VM or a group of VMs or a provision, they will see a drop-down menu of the networks available that the UCS Manager created. And it bypasses the vSwitch, it replaces the vSwitch, the distributed vSwitch in VMware. And if you go, if you send a frame from one VM to another in the same ESXi host, it actually goes up to the vSwitch, or it goes up to the Fabric Interconnect. So you can do security, not security policies on it, but QoS and all that, and we'll send it back down to the same host. So there's no local switching.
Visibility.
Yeah.
You get what you do with that visibility is up to you. It might be access lists, you know, VACLs or RACLs on the layer 3 interface. It can be span, so that if you've got to audit all the traffic for some purpose or capture all the traffic for some purpose. But you can also configure the MES card to actually do local switching as well. So you can do VEB. So in the 802.1BR standard, there's two things. There's one called this port extender, which actually extends the port all the way back up to the root of the 802.1BR, which is bridge port extension. But the other part is virtual Ethernet bridging, which is local switching on the FEX card itself. But that will come in the future.
So the big driver, why would someone want to go the VM FEX route? Is it strictly that visibility, you're channeling everything into a piece of hardware so that you can apply some sort of a policy to it? It seems like in some ways you could say, I'm spending money and maybe losing a bit of flexibility.
Everything you can do with a regular vSwitch. So I'm trying to think if there's any way you do lose flexibility. And I don't think boost in – Cisco says a 30% boost, and I've seen numbers that jive with that in terms of being able to push throughput. So if you have like really bandwidth-heavy VMs, like a backup VM, you can get some performance benefits on that, and it drops the CPU utilization down because the CPU isn't busy copying the frames from the interface to the VM. And
so okay, so I mean you can use it as a you're offloading the function of the soft switch and putting it back into hardware, but you still have the virtualization kind of flexibility and functionality that's there.
And that's one benefit. The other benefit, the classic problem is of you know, your VMware team, who does the networking in the VMware team? If you have vSwitches in VMware, who does the network? Typically, it's the VMware team. So this would give the control of the network back to the networking team, and the virtualization team can concentrate on system administration.
Well, okay, actually, that's an interesting point, because today it's the first scenario you were talking about. If you've got a vSwitch environment, which is what I'm dealing with, I hand the guy some 802.1Q trunks, the guy meaning the VMware administrator that I work with, and he deals with the networking from there, and we have to coordinate on VLAN tags. But once the packet leaves my switch and heads into his VMware cluster, I don't know what happens to the traffic. It's all his world. So with VM FEX, what am I as a network administrator now dealing with?
So you basically handle all of the QoS, you handle all of the traffic shaping, you handle all of the layer 2 security, and you create the networks.
And I do that from what administration point?
The UCS manager.
Okay.
So one of the interesting things that's happening with UCS is that most of the server hardware is actually being given to the networking team in most circuits. So in the past, server hardware has always been the responsibility of the server administrator. But one of the things I'm seeing in the last 10 or so UCS sites that people I've spoken to who run Cisco UCS, the Cisco UCS is actually run by the networking people, not by the server people.
Exactly. And it doesn't need to be any different, because the real magic happens for the server team in the virtualization realm or the bare metal realm, and they still get the KVM access and all that through the UCS manager. They can get access to all that they need. But the frustration point is that demarcation point. I mean, the old world used to be you had a server and you had a switch. and you plugged them into each other, and the server team never talked to the networking team, because I've been on both sides, and the conversation went something like this. Here's your default gateway. Here's your IP addresses, and don't talk to me.
Yeah, well, that was necessary because we didn't have a common language. So in the past, the guys were talking operating systems, and we were talking network hardware, and we didn't have a language for which to talk to each other about. Even inside of the server teams, the guys who did server hardware often didn't get along with the guys who did server OSs. So that is, you know, the Linux guy and the Windows guy were worried about their operating systems. They didn't really get too much bothered about the hardware, the actual hardware they ran on. There'd be usually inside the team, there'd be in a server team, there's one guy who really cares about the server hardware and can quote HP memory modules and, you know, knows the part numbers and the SKUs for all these bits and pieces and loves running off to the data center to plug in more memory, you know. Works all night. But in UCS environments, it's really fascinating to see networking people take over the UCS provisioning. So they run the UCS manager, because the networking the UCS manager is mostly networking. It doesn't make sense for operating systems people to get involved with the server hardware in a UCS environment.
Yeah, and there's not much that they would need to have that interaction with, because most of the stuff that they do is in the virtualized in the OS world anyway, and that's abstracted away in anyway.
Anyway, everybody's mileage may vary, but that's the interesting thing that I've noted is that UCS tends to be handled by the networking team, not server guys.
I would agree. So that gets us along to something I've learned very recently, is that you can also do VMFEX with the Nexus 5500s. So you can actually configure a Nexus 5500 without UCS, so beyond UCS. Use the Nexus 5500, plug it into a C-Series, and you can do VMFEX on 5500.
Meaning if you log into your 5500, it looks like you've got another fabric extender, except this one just happens to be plugged in the back of a C-Class Blade Center.
Then you join it with a vCenter instance, and the port profiles you create in 5500 get presented to vSphere. They communicate back and forth, so you can create port profiles, port groups, I forget what they're called. And that way, again, it takes the networking and puts it back into the networking team's hands instead of the server team's hands.
So it's more than just you see a fex like any other top-of-rack fex. There's actually all that additional functionality that you're gaining there with the plug-in to vCenter.
Exactly. So it's quite different than it's more than just a Nexus 2000.
Probably worth observing at this point that the C-Series is a rack-mount server and the B-Series is a blade-mounted. So a B-Series server always goes inside of a chassis and has its own, and so it uses the chassis UCS 2200 and the IM module FEX to communicate to the FI, and that bonds them all together. And the fabric interconnect can bond up to 5, 10, 15 chassis into one functional unit. The UCS manager handles all the configuration. C-Series servers tend towards the standalone. So if you're somebody who might be just saying, I just want 3 or 4 servers and I want to buy Cisco C-Series to do that, then they can then just plug into your 5000 directly. And on each one of those C-Series is a CIMC and an IOM, which actually then connects to the 5500. And that's how it works. It's very different to the B-Series in that sense.
Yep. So the C-Series you can use as just a pizza box. So it's a rack mount. It comes in anywhere between 1 RU to 4 RU. You can use it as a pizza box. You can maintain it separately. You don't have to have UCS manager. You don't have to have fabric interconnects with it. You can just have it be a pizza box.
Yeah, plug in a dongle which breaks out into, you know, 2 USBs, 1 video, 1 keyboard port.
Right. Or you can also integrate it in with the UCS manager. You can with a pair of fabric interconnects. You need a Nexus 2200 to hang off of the fabric interconnect, and then you plug your C-Series directly into that 2200 to break out that bandwidth. You used to have to plug the C-Series directly into fabric interconnects, but now you don't have to do that. And then it will treat it just like a node, just like a B-Series. You can actually migrate a service profile B-Series blade to a C-Series, provided hardware resources for both. In addition, you can take a C-Series and plug it into a Nexus 5000 and get a little bit of extra functionality. Not quite the control you get with UCS Manager, but you, if you have the P81E card or the new VIC 1225, you can also do these faked out NICs. So I can fake out these NICs and present VMware with what looks like 6 or 8 NICs and do QS and traffic shaping and all that.
Okay, so that's 802.1BR there. So what you're actually doing there is part of the VEB functionality, if I remember rightly.
Right, and that requires the Nexus 5000.
Yeah, so you're actually establishing a connection between the VIC and the Nexus 5000, and they're actually communicating to each other over an S channel to keep the configurations in sync. So the NIC is communicating with the switch to say, this is what I'm looking like, and the switch gets that data and then adds it to its configuration, and the switch also has data passing back to the NIC. So where before the NIC was just some dumb statically configured thing, they actually now communicate over the Ethernet using a communications channel to say, here's some data going back and forth. So if the VIC needs to say, hang on, my primary path is gone, I need to now use my secondary path, the VIC actually communicates to the switch and says, hi, you know, this is what's happened, this is what we need to do, let's do the failover, away we go.
What's interesting about this conversation?
Yeah, I think we've done this to death. I think we're going to do it. I think we're probably going to be doing it a few more times yet between now and the end of the year, probably. But that's it for the show this week, and thanks for listening to the Packet Pushers. We should be back again in about a week or so, so make sure you come back. I'd like to thank Tony Burke for joining us this week. Tony, tell us where people can find you.
I blog online on datacenteroverlords.com. You can also find me on Twitter at tburke, that's T-B-O-U-R-K-E. And this week I'm heading to Toronto. Next week I'm heading to Montreal and training for my next marathon.
Marathon. How long? A half marathon or the full 26? Like, how long's a marathon these days?
26.2 miles, yeah, full one.
Yeah.
And it's a solar eclipse marathon, so the starting gun is actually when the solar eclipse occurs.
That's pretty cool.
Wow, yeah. Especially when you realize he's a vegetarian. So to be like him, you have to actually have to work fairly hard at diet and strange things like that.
Vegan,
yes. And Ethan, tell us about yourself.
Well, hey, I'll be getting some projects behind me and tweeting at EC Banks and blogging at packetpushers.net and publishing podcasts and on all those other sorts of things. I'd appreciate it if you'd follow me on Twitter and read the blogs and all that good stuff, because I really want to own all of your spare brain cycles should be about things that I'm writing. So. Actually, Twitter is just not all that interesting, but I do tweet about news articles and things like that that I find interesting and think someone else might find interesting as well. And, of course, I blog about networking stuff, you know. Yeah. So,
Of course, I'm Greg Farrow. You can find me on my blog at etherealmind.com or on the Twitter as at etherealmind. We apologize a little bit for some slow posting in the last couple of weeks. Both Ethan and I have been snowed under with our day jobs, and that's not likely to change, so it's possible there might be a bit of a slow pace for the next month or so. We are going to be picking things back up just as long as we get things battled out, so we apologize in advance. Just might be 10 days or 12 days between shows instead of the normal weekly publishing schedule until we get our lives back in order. As always, we'd love to hear your feedback about today's show, so send an email to packetpushers@gmail.com. Let us know what you're thinking. Alternatively, you can check out the podcast website at packetpushers.net and leave comments on today's show, or follow us on the Twitter as at packetpushers. And as always, remember that too much networking would never be enough.